Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Hey, welcome to another episode of This Life with Bob Forrest and Dr. Drew. What was that?
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Oh, you're ready for people to
call? I'm just getting in a groove.
Let me remind people, yeah, just some business to get out of the way. Please go to either thislifepodcast.com or drdrew.com to click through on the Amazon banner to support this project. And it doesn't cost you a thing, but we get a little bit of whatever you do there. And also, you can see the back podcast, the previous podcast there as well. So,
and you can find us at This Life Podcast on Twitter.
Ooh, we have a Twitter handle
too now.
We're growing. And by the way, just these things only survive by word of mouth. So if you like what we're doing, and by the way, if you don't like, email us, let us know what we can do to do better. But if you do like it, tell a friend. It does help out. That's how stuff happens.
We're supposed to be a community of human beings on planet Earth. I don't know what happened. We're all Twittering and podcasting and this thing and that thing.
Well, yeah.
We need to just talk.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a bigger topic if you want to get into that. But I think social media has been, it has some benefits, but it's a net negative.
Here's an interesting thing. Whenever I see you, we talk for whatever 30 minutes or an hour that we're together and it's still unfinished and there's a million things more to talk about.
Yep.
Other friends of mine, I haven't seen them in 6 months. So you get there and they're like, hey, what's up? I'm like, dude, what have you been doing? I've been Elvis and they're like, because people have lost the ability or the art of conversation.
Well, they we don't know how to connect anymore.
It's weird.
Yeah. And I suppose males are worse than anybody because we are sort of naturally not inclined to talk.
Yeah.
Women, there's all this data that women's reward systems go off when they talk.
No, because I'm a natural talker and I have to cue them. Like, dude, I saw on Facebook, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah. No, I played in Japan.
Well, tell people about your tour.
What I mean? All these things that happen, you see them on Facebook and then you see the person like, what's been happening? Nothing. You know what I mean? But I've been on tour and I've been talking to a lot of people.
What's the name of your record?
It's called Survival Songs.
Nice.
On 6 Degrees Records. It's a real record and vinyl.
We probably have that at Amazon. Click through the Amazon.
I have some for you, too, you guys.
Okay, cool.
So, but I've been meeting a lot of people, interesting things going on.
Mm.
You know, Minneapolis at a commie bookstore. It was a great thing.
Commie?
Yeah, that's what I call it. They call it progressives now. I was the original progressive. It's called commie.
Okay, got it.
Right? And, no books, not bombs and all that kind of stuff. And I just loved it. And I love the people. And what I've noticed in this whole month that I've been touring, people are a little bit more, I don't know, they're a little bit easier to negotiate with.
By the way, if you hear music in the background, it's my son playing
there he is.
Rachmaninoff.
But my politics has shifted more towards center, right?
Yeah.
So I meet old commies and I tell them, I don't think, we need to recite chapter and verse LBGYN all the time. You know what I mean? All the political correctness of the left.
Oh.
I just can't stand it.
Yeah.
And they can't stand it either. Whereas 5 or 10 years ago, you'd be like, you know what? People are dying for the right to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I see the left softening a little bit.
Yeah, good.
Right? And I met a bunch of Republicans and conservatives out in Nevada where I'm working.
Yeah.
And they're more, the true Republicans are more level-headed and more commonsensical. It's the whack jobs that are on television
in this country.
On both sides.
Because there's no shortage on both sides.
Because I've got to meet a lot of different people. And
it makes me libertarian. I just want the government the hell out of my life.
I think that's where everyone's shifting. Yeah. I think that's where the common sense is.
I want to see youth go there before I know it's actually happening.
I don't think the youth care. You know what I mean? That's a sad thing. I see a lot of youth jump on militant bandwagons.
They're sure interested in preferred gender pronouns.
Yeah. That trans. I got lectured about trans.
Well,
that's the short for it.
You can't say that. You have to say transgender.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And you can't, and you have to ask somebody what their preferred gender pronoun is. And you need to know that it and they are part of the preferred gender pronouns.
All right, let me tell you something. Go read Scar Tissue by Anthony Kiedis. In 1983, I was in Cleveland. I was very friendly with some trans people.
No. This
intimately
is,
friendly this with is, some trans people.
this is even independent of transgender issues and identity. It's gender.
It's the politics of gender. I know. Yeah. And so, but when you just talk with people, everybody's kind of wants a solution. I think that we're all kind of scared and tired of fighting.
Well,
but
part
you
of the
see
fear,
so much fighting on television.
No, the fear is you say something on social media, you get a mob reaction. The most primitive reaction possible. Not a thoughtful response by thoughtful people. A mob develops. This is what Kathy Griffin was talking about. My wife brought up that we were watching Kathy Griffin's show, that she said something sort of snarky about Demi Lovato, and the Lovatics mobilized.
Against her.
Yeah, they were going to kill her. They threatened repeatedly to kill her.
Well, you don't recall my leaving Twitter immediately upon, because VH1 wanted me to Twitter when the show was going. I started Twittering a little bit, right, or whatever it was. Yeah, I think it was Twitter at the time. And Michael Jackson died. Mm. And I simply tweeted one thing.
Oh.
Let me get this straight. This was day 3 post Christ risen of Michael Jackson. I said, let me get this straight. So 4 days ago, this man was an unemployed, what everybody believed to be pedophile.
Stop. And the other thing people forget is you could have picked up a British news rag, a celebrity rag, the day before he died, and he would have been called Wacko Jacko.
Yes.
That
and
was
now,
who they thought
just
of him.
By passing away, he's now become Christ-like.
Yeah.
What is wrong with us as a nation? I just feel for the guy.
Yeah.
That's all I said.
He was
a sick drug addict
got mistreated.
People wanted to kill me.
Yeah, well, if you say he's a drug addict, they freak out too. We'll hear from them just with this podcast. We will. I'm not kidding.
I love Michael Jackson, but I know he was sick. And I know that he was treated like a leper in our society,
like veal.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, like in a sack feeding him. Come on.
And then all of a sudden he died, and he was the greatest kid ever. And this gets back to your idea about the Aztecs.
Well, my idea. One thing I want to remember to do is review our history together, because we've still never done that.
Yeah.
What I had told Bob once, I was trying to understand.
Modern media.
Yeah, what's going on in social media? Why this mob? Maybe it was even before social media. I sort of predicted a little bit why mob was becoming the way.
Well, it was TMZ and it was People Magazine. Yeah. It was this viciousness and towards Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears. That's why I thought these are little girls. Why is everybody attacking them?
Right. And what I said was that when I look across history, I was trying to understand the anthropology and the history of narcissism. And I was like, because you and I have witnessed this narcissistic trend. I mean, you go to any psychiatric hospital in the country and you will see under the personality spectrums, narcissism is the exclusive diagnosis or narcissistic spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things with borderline, sociopath, narcissist, those are all narcissistic personality issues. And that's exclusively what you see now. When I first started working in psychiatric hospital in the early 80s, you would see dependent personalities, obsessive compulsive personalities, all kinds of stuff. Now it's exclusively, and we've all seen it, the narcissistic
shit. So that's
shit.
Telling of our society is what you're
yeah,
saying.
And I was right. And I was saying that I've written books about this. And so everyone knows that we've all kind of know we're shifting towards narcissism as our predominant personality style. But I was trying to understand where else that has existed in history and what the implications of that are. And so I started looking around, and I thought, oh my God, where you see really severe childhood trauma and severe narcissistic response, the two places I could find...
Central and South America.
No. Well, the Aztecs. The Aztecs had something called the Codex, which was an instruction manual about how to create a warrior, essentially. How you abuse the fuck out of your kids,
like
including
how you
them
make
holding
a pit
them over,
bull. How you make a pit bull
holding
fight.
Them over fires and things. Like if they misbehave, you put them in this cage and hold them over fire at a certain period of time. It was like crazy, crazy stuff. And then I thought, oh well, no wonder they want to tear someone's heart out after that to become great warriors. That's how you create a warrior. It's just like creating abused dogs. Those abused dogs, you can then throw in a pit bull ring, or a dog fighting ring. But the same. Then I started thinking, well, okay, there's this phenomenon. There's a guy named Rene Girard that writes
about... The
French guy. He's actually a literary analysis guy.
He's the guy that created the Hummer. He was the wasn't he the research behind that women would want a Hummer because it keeps their kids safe?
No. He develops a theory called the mimetic desire, mimetic passions, which he was looking at sort of patterns in literature and said, oh my God, there's always people, I'm gonna really paraphrase very poorly, but people gather together and sort of raise one up only to cut it down.
Yeah.
We'll raise one up and knock it down. Especially, and I saw that especially in narcissistic periods of history, pre-French Revolution, pre-revolutionary France. It's another time where if you really look around, like fucking Rousseau. Do you know who Rousseau?
Yeah, yeah.
Left five kids at an orphanage, just handed them off. This poor woman that kept giving birth, and he goes, yeah, take it down to the orphanage, just leave it. Five kids. And that was routine back then. They would just abandon kids all over the place. You don't think that created some narcissistic injury?
Yeah.
And then
and then
they would physically abuse them if they raised them. And yeah. he had both. He had abandonment and physical abuse in his life. And he wrote about it in a book called The Confessions. It's really one of the first
Augustine or
that's St. Augustine wrote The Confessions.
I have that book. But I know the one.
I think it's Confessions too. It's like the first autobiography. I'll check that. Anyway, it's it chronicles all this trauma and stuff, trauma. And then guess what? You get a revolutionary France. People want to take the people that they've elevated and then destroy them.
So I try a little social experiment. Yesterday, I was getting my toenails done by chance, but that's a whole other story.
Aren't you cool?
So when I was on
Facebook, my wife's been trying to get me to do for years, I will never subject myself to. I couldn't do it. If somebody's sitting at your feet, it's like so weird.
It is kind of weird. Anyways, I digress. I'm on Facebook, and there's this attack of the band NOFX because one of their members didn't recognize Keith Morris, a legendary punk rock singer, on an airplane. And all I simply did, I chimed in, I said, hey, let's not attack a band just,
stupid stuff
like this. The attack then came towards me.
Yes. Well, so this is the mob that develops.
All I said.
Right. This is the mob that develops. And a mob that's traumatized and narcissistically oriented is not happy until there's blood. It's a way of galvanizing the crowd so they don't act out on each other.
So anyways, this leads us to Celebrity Rehab. I believe that a lot of the audience who watch Celebrity Rehab liked seeing them suffer through detox.
Schadenfreude is the name.
Yes. Then they got bored as they started to give, the reasons why over a series of episodes of why Dennis Rodman is the way he is, of what explains Heidi.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Her neurobiology and her brain.
Yeah.
And Dennis has 49 brothers and sisters. Oof. I mean, come on. Yeah. Did you know that?
So you're not on mic anymore, Susan. Turn your mic on.
Okay. We were starting to show why they are the assholes that the public perceives, right?
Yeah.
The numbers start to go down. And if you recall, big numbers for when they're detoxing, numbers started to kind of peak about episode 4 or 5. By the time
they're getting better,
it starts to come back up to the finale, right?
Yeah. So they feel vindicated from their guilt.
Yeah, somehow they were doing it over 10 episodes of a reality TV show.
Interesting.
Just by the numbers. Start with 2.8, go down to 1.3. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And then the end is equal to the beginning. So they like that, watching them suffer, and I not feel sorry for these people, and then like, oh, it's so great
that
they're doing good.
So that's the American...
Happily ever after.
I understand. It's not been designed that way, but I do understand that I've experienced that, as I've observed, how people behave...
Life is not like that. Life is
but
way
listen,
more complicated.
What we like is stories of resurrection. So we like the comeback story, right? So we love indulging in feeding off people that are fallen. And then we like to give them a chance to come back to relieve us of our guilt.
For liking them being down there.
Correct. It just gives us, and it also tells us we have the possibility of resurrection.
So then here's
too.
Why I think the public turned on us. So... They're leaving on a happy note. These people are doing great. They're going to be ballerinas and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then they die.
Hits. Yeah, reality hits.
And who's to blame? You.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's
because the reality
is
drug addicts die all the time. And they die of their disease no matter what we do. Especially when
you know how many people in my direct family have died of alcoholism or drug addiction?
Oh, yeah.
Too many to count.
Yeah.
Suicide, alcoholism, cirrhosis of the liver, heart disease from alcoholism, then second generation drug addiction, incarceration, AIDS, third generation prescription drug overdose, three generations of four is dying.
Ugh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a dangerous condition in this culture.
America knows that because now they're dying the in their family.
Well, now it's happening.
Now it's happening. It's
because it's so pervasive now. It's sick.
So what do? We got to get people on the right track. You got to talk. You got to have good boundaries.
It's also why the whole replacement movement has stepped up because it's desperation.
Yeah.
People are desperate. And there's no money to treat it properly. So
why not just
give a replacement? Yeah. It does work. It works, you know, in a limited way. Works for some well. And you know, I don't want to
scare you, but you know what I'm seeing a really big increase in?
What?
Them not taking the replacement drugs that the medical profession's in favor of and going to pot. I know a lot of heroin addicts smoking pot.
And you know what?
I always wait for them to go back to heroin. And I got to tell you, Drew, the last 2 or 3 years, they're not.
I know.
The pot must be so strong, they're just anesthetized.
It is, but I'd prefer them to be on pot than a lot of other things.
Than Suboxone?
I can't say that in any kind of meaningful way in terms of...
But I see it. I see it happening in real time.
I've seen marijuana maintenance. I've seen that. And I think the people that advocate for clinical pot would also say that they prescribe it that way. And
I think they do.
Yeah, I would rather see somebody on pot than heroin. I'd rather see somebody on pot than Oxycontin, than Vicodin, all these other oral opiates.
I don't want to see kids on anything.
Right. I don't think you can...
19, 20, 22, I don't like that.
I don't think you can aspire to a flourishing existence doing any of these things.
We got a call. You're chronically ill, yeah. Calling in.
All right. Hold on, they're going to call in just a second. This is somebody who emailed us at drdrew.com, and then we set up the Skype.
Hi.
Hey there.
Hey, howdy, howdy.
Oh, listen to the dog in the
background. That's cute.
That's the best. What kind of dog is that?
Sorry, she's a German Shepherd Lab.
Fantastic.
It's going to trigger the dogs here.
Yeah, I know. Barking. It's just in our headset, at least. All right, so what is your name?
I'm Kiera.
Kiera. All right, yeah. Kiera, thanks for calling us. What's your question?
My mom has severe bipolar disorder, and she's a recovering alcoholic and, you know, prescription drugs and does meth on occasion. Well,
Hold on. How old is she?
44.
And how long has she been, quote, sober?
It's been on and off since I was five.
Does she in the program? Does she go to meetings?
She doesn't go to meetings.
Did she ever?
When I was younger, she did. I would say like the past 5 years, she hasn't gone to a meeting. It's more just her staying sober on her own.
Does she go to rehabs a lot or no?
She went to two rehabs, but all that was probably about 10 years ago.
And when you say she does meth occasionally, how often?
I would say every couple months, she kind of disappears for a couple days, and then she'll come home and she'll be completely out of it. Like, I found out last night she was gone. And then she just showed up a couple hours ago.
Uh-huh.
And she's kind of erratic right now.
Do you live with her?
Yeah, I lived with my aunt for a while, but I moved back home.
Are you there now and your mom's in that house somewhere?
Yeah, I'm in my room.
Would she talk to us?
Possibly. She's kind of out of character.
I'll talk to her. I'll talk to her. Does she know who I am or we are?
She must
have watched Celebrity Rehab before, huh?
Yeah.
Or no?
He watches VH1 a lot.
Okay.
Wait, before you get it, because as a physician, I can't really.
Oh, you don't want to.
No, you can. I can't.
Okay.
But listen, I can only do educational stuff across state lines on the internet stuff.
Okay, why don't we do this? Why don't we talk with you and then maybe set up something for next time that I'll talk to your mother?
Okay, that works.
So we'll just talk.
That's fine. But she can come in. It's fine. But I want to know more about what's going on. Is this bipolar diagnosis? Is it perhaps that it's all the meth and she's really not bipolar?
That's what I was thinking. If it's more just like an environmental thing, or...
Well, not environmental, a brain thing that you can induce things that look like bipolar if you use methamphetamine. If she didn't tell whoever, whatever doctor that was doing the assessment that she's doing meth pretty regularly, you know. But it sort of is a moot point because you're going to treat the bipolar either way. It oftentimes we would treat the bipolar, they get sober, you can take them off the bipolar meds and see if it was really bipolar or not. And sometimes it would not have been bipolar had they not been a drug addict, or it wasn't bipolar in the first place. But in the meantime, you have to treat it as though it is because their moods are off.
Yeah. Well, she does take like Lututa and stuff like that. And when she's not on her psych meds.
Who are you talking to about me?
When she's not on her psych meds.
Lamictal? She takes Lamictal and Lututa? Is that right?
Yeah. So when she's not on her psych meds, she really...
She struggles.
Yeah, so she'll be a completely different person to the point where she's talking, like talking about religious fanatic things, like talking completely out of character. She's not functional,
normal person. That's either an amphetamine psychosis and or mania. So, and Lamictal Latude, that's a good combination. I mean, but she has to take it. And the meth will push right on through that, by the way. And by the way, people who are taking meth aren't into taking their meds, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what I've always come to learn after all these years is no one is one thing, and we just keep doing an either or. Everybody is complicated. So you have personality problems, you have possibly
mood problems.
My mood problems.
Yeah.
And then you have addiction problems, you have trauma problems, you have abandonment issues.
Right.
You have all these things and all the things that those things create in a life. Unemployment, unstable living environment, estranged relationships.
Yeah.
So it's all this big cluster, and everybody wants a simple answer. They're bipolar, so put them on, you know, this, and everything should be all right. And it makes the person with the problem, you know, feel like, no, nobody's listening to me.
Yeah.
Because medicine alone does not help.
It helps, but it's not the...
It's not the silver bullet.
Beginning of the ending,
You know what I mean?
Well, it's why, listen, all the research shows that whenever you treat somebody for mental health issues, medication plus talk of some type, you know, some sort of therapeutic intervention, always has better outcomes. Always, always, always.
I believe in prioritizing.
Sure. What's that?
I've always tried to push her to go to therapy. Like, I myself went when I was younger, and every time I suggest that she won't go. I mean, I know there's a lot of things in her past as far as
trauma.
Yeah, like her and my grandma don't get along at all. Like,
sure. Well, listen, the one thing you've got to do is take care of yourself, right?
Yeah.
And you sound pretty centered. You sound pretty together. But I know under that superficial togetherness, this really causes you a lot of distress and pain, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, a program called Al-Anon, you go there, get a sponsor, work with them, or get a therapist or both for yourself. It will help you help her, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Al-Anon.
Go to a program called Al-Anon. Just look it up online. There'll be a program near you. Just go there, tell your story, get some support, get a sponsor, and you'll be surprised how much good that does, not just for you, but for your ability to help her.
Okay.
See how I do that, Bob? I always tell the codependents, you'll end up helping them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they won't go otherwise. If it's just for me, I won't go.
Here's another thing. When you come from parents like that, you constantly want their love and approval, and you never get it, really. And so you need to get it from other places around in your life that you don't really expect that love and approval is okay to get. From your closest friends, from family members, from people that... mentors. You've got to get nurtured and fed.
Right. That's
and
right.
You're not so you can't get nurtured and fed from somebody who can't nurture and feed you. And once they've pretty much, you know, made it obvious they can't do that, you need to still get nurtured and fed.
There's that, and I hear in your particular, I feel from what I feel from you, this is scary. This is scary for you.
It is.
Yeah, you're afraid. And to be in a supportive environment with people that have dealt with this and can give you good counsel minute to minute and support you as you deal with it can really reduce your anxiety about this. I hear how scared you are.
It's hard. Like, I don't know. I feel like I'm parenting my parent.
Of course.
Well, that's what you're doing. That's what Bob is talking about, is when you can't get the nurturing you need from the one who is supposed to give it, you need to go out and get it from someone, and there are people that will provide it.
They're probably in your life. You just need to look elsewhere.
Okay. How old are you?
23.
Yeah, you got it. You need to be getting on with your life, too. You can't let it drag you down.
That's Do you go to thing. School?
I took this past year off.
See,
but
because I'm worried about mom.
It was a tough year just because this past year she's been leaving a lot and kind of disappearing. And I don't know. I started, you know, having to work two jobs. Oh. So it was just a little stressful.
A little stressful. What happened? I like the way you minimize it.
What happened with your aunt? How come you had to move out of your aunt?
Well, I didn't have to. It was just because.
You're going
to
go save mom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course.
You're like, not gonna be
I
able
feel
to
like
save her.
She feels a lot better when I'm here. She doesn't, you know, disappear as much. I feel like she.
Yeah, but you can't be chained to her.
You can't bring your you can't have her life pull your life into its vortex.
When's the last time you went out and saw a movie you wanted to go see?
I don't know, like a month ago?
Okay, you need to live your life. That's pretty good.
You have to do one thing for us out of this conversation. You must go to Al-Anon. You got to promise us you're going to go.
Don't feel guilty about having your own life. Yeah. That's what moms like that do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's got a lot, you know. It's probably never going to be perfect with mom, but
yeah.
Hopefully she'll, you know, somebody's treating her. That's good news. Maybe you can get her to go to some NA meetings or something. You know, some 12-step meetings again. You know, I've seen a lot of identified addicts start to go, particularly ones that have been to meetings in the past, will start to go when they see their loved one going to Al-Anon.
Really?
Yep. Yep. Okay.
Hey, Bob, tell everybody how to find Al-Anon.
So Al-Anon, you just look it up online. Al-Anon or Nar-Anon, it's called. Narcotics Anonymous for family members.
I like the Al-Anon better. It's just been better.
Yeah. Al-Anon's more ready available. Where are you? What town are you in?
Orange County.
Oh, yeah. There's a million. Call up a place. What's that place called? Call up a place called Northbound. And ask them for a referral for family members of addicts.
Okay.
But they're going to they might want to give full treatment, though.
Of Al-Anon.
Yeah, Al-Anon referral.
They'll give Al-Anon. Tell them that Bob Forrest told you to call and you're looking for Al-Anon support groups.
Good ones.
In that area.
In your area. In your area.
Because they'll know where they recommend is the best ones.
Okay.
Okay?
That's Northbound Treatment Services on Von Carmen.
In Costa Mesa,
Costa
right?
Costa Mesa.
And the phone number is 949-650-4334.
They're great treatment.
949-650-4334.
Okay.
All right, my dear. Good luck. You need lots of support. That's the main thing. It's gonna be a little bit of a marathon, as you well know. But go back to school. Take care of yourself. Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
You got it. Thanks for calling.
So let's talk about this. So. The main thing that you have with a mother like that is they're going to die.
Yeah.
And they usually don't.
No, I know.
My mother's been going for 30 years since I thought she was going to die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But
you live your whole life trying to save them from dying.
Well, the problem is that's the same thing, though, that parents fantasize is going to happen to their kids.
Same mechanism.
But the kids do die.
Yeah, the kids are
dying. The kids are dying.
But the moms, it's been a mess for 20 years. Yeah. Like, she's going to be all right.
But the addict then plays on, without not consciously, they play on the fear, yeah.
Yeah, that's why they don't answer their phones. Listen, it's still all the basics.
Stuff you used to do?
Yeah, don't answer your phone. They'll start worrying about you. Stop calling them. Why switch the tables on them?
Right. Well, the magically,
what I mean? If
they'll,
you want to run off and take drugs.
They'll be butthurt when you don't call. Hysterical.
Here's what I do with families. You want to know and tell me if this is wrong, Drew? We haven't been working side by side with cases in a long time.
Yeah.
So when a child is in my care or in rehab or whatever, and they leave and they're on a run and they won't answer their phone, and the mothers are beside themselves and they're going to fly from Milwaukee out here and all this kind of stuff, I always say, do me a favor, disconnect their phone. Because it's always the parents are always paying the cell phone. I say, shut that phone off.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you they'll call.
Yeah.
And they always do.
Right.
I'm like 11 for 11 with that.
It's because the money's going
to
go.
They need the phone to make
call
the
their
drug
dealers. Yeah. But not only that, they also feel like, that my resources, you know, my lifeline of money and whatnot is going to get cut off.
Yeah, yeah. Just cut off the phone and you'll find out where they are
pretty
quick.
It's a big message. It's very good.
Yeah, it's a good one.
So we have a couple of people that couldn't Skype and wanted you to read their
okay. Is that okay, these two
questions?
All right. Before I do, I want to tell it. I guess I'll wrap up by telling the story of how we got together. But let's do these okay. emails first. I don't know where to begin. This is from Patricia. My niece is tearing our family apart. She's gone inpatient several times. She keeps friends that guide her back to drugs. I tell her if they were real friends, they would support her and not offer her drugs. I'm an RN, and I honestly thought I could help because I've dealt with many, many, many patients. But even I cannot make a difference. We're supportive. We don't understand how much. She doesn't understand how much we are hurting. She lies. There's an answer for everything. A one-month inpatient center only helps for a couple of months, and it's back to drugs. We cannot leave her alone, but we work full time, and it's difficult to continue to ask for time off from work. Oh boy, his the same kind of story. Oh, this
exactly
is now,
the same.
Brother takes Mondays off to stay home with her. My sister, see, this is no. This is
not
how you do this. No. She has full life in front of her. She's only 21. She's tried to end her life several years ago. Is there a facility requirement in Phoenix? Of course, a ton of them in Phoenix. Phoenix would be
Cottonwood. Cottonwood and Sierra Tucson.
Sierra Tucson,
and,
yeah.
There's a third one out there, the Meadows.
The Meadows is in Tucson, though, I think. For somebody like this, I would recommend the Meadows if they can take them over
it's
to Tucson.
It's only 100 miles, Drew.
From Tucson to Phoenix?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
I would go to the Meadows because she sounds like she has a personality disorder in addition to addiction.
But
the amount of chaos. They're contributing to the trouble.
You know, I wrote a short story about my dad. Yeah. And every time I hear stuff like this, and I deal with this on a 24-hour-a-day
family
basis,
members doing this kind of thing,
and I just think my dad would be rolling over in his grave. Like, what the fuck? Who's sitting home with the drug addict person so they don't take drugs? What the hell is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The old-fashioned, commonsensical approach.
Yeah.
Like, the family is sicker than the drug addict.
Well, it all, I would say... Not to take aim at these people, but many families.
I'm not saying them in particular. I'm just saying what goes on.
Families become sick because they have a drug addict in their family. I will give them that. It's not as though they're all sick and they're all emotionally disturbed. It's that the addiction pulls them into the illness.
I have to comment on that. We talked about narcissism. Yep. That's very narcissistic for a brother to think, oh, I'll just stay home on Mondays from work.
Yep. And I'll make you better.
Yep.
Even if it's a codependent impulse, like sort of an Andy Dick sort of codependency, it's still a reverse narcissism. It's like, I need your pain makes me unable to function.
And that's codependency also.
Yeah, that's codependency.
Right.
Yeah.
So that you know, parents need to, I don't know, how do we convey back? Like, I have good work ethic. I know right from wrong. I've always known right from wrong. I just choose wrong because I'm whatever.
Shitty.
Right.
It's family stuff. We haven't
but
told your story
the
yet.
The fundamentals of that generation who raised the 50 somethings, we threw it all baby out with the bathwater, and some of it was really fucking good.
Yes, it's true.
Like, accountability.
It's I've not heard it articulated quite so clearly, but I think you're right.
You know what I mean?
And also a little bit of, it's not tough love so much as common sense.
Common sense.
Yeah, just common sense parenting, yeah.
That we, and I certainly have done it with my kid or with close family members. Yeah. You know, I was chasing Anthony around a lot when he relapsed.
Anthony Keyes,
he had 5 years, and then he was abusing for about 2 years, and now he's got like 15 years. But those 2 years, me and Louie and Flea and everybody was chasing him around. We traced his credit card down and tried to surprise him at a hotel and all this. Finally, I just got tired of him. I was like, fuck it. And those guys were going to run around look for him again, and I said, I'll wait right here. He knows where I fucking live.
Yeah.
And you know what? A few weeks later, he called me. He goes, what do you think I should do? And I go, I don't know. I literally didn't, because we had tried everything, treatment here, treatment there, go here, go do this, that. And finally I said, you need to get back to the basics somehow. And he went home to his mom's, went to AA.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, very simple.
Very simple stuff. Yeah. But this chasing someone around and all the drama
and track their
credit card.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
The fear, though, of course, the 21-year-old's going to die, and it's a legitimate potential, potential. This family needs to go get treatment. For me, this is somebody needs to be away for 3 to 6 months. If you really want to try to do something, you try to put away for 6 months. Like
There's also a hint in that letter that they're starting to not believe treatment works. So she's been to treatment 2 times. Listen, she might have to go 20 more times.
Yeah.
That frightens people.
You went 22 times, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
Do you feel that any of those were a waste of time?
No, you learn a lot. Here's one thing I always recognized, and it got entrenched in me. I am an addict because I would go to these places and be with addicts and I fit right in. I'm connected. I am the same. I have this regardless of where education or background or whatever. I really connected with I'm an addict. The question was, am I willing to do what's necessary to stay sober? And
right.
I wasn't.
That's always the question. Simple. That's always the issue.
But
really.
I was in many mental hospitals also, and I never felt like this is where I belong.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was on lockdowns against my will and stuff. CPC Westwood, do you ever practice there?
I'm familiar with it, but I never did.
I was on the locked unit
Paul
for
Williams
a month.
Paul Williams used to be there.
Yeah, and so did Buddy Arnold work there.
Oh, Buddy Arnold.
I was on the locked unit for a month just because I tried to kill myself. What's the big deal about that? Come on now. But
they may have saved your life, though.
Every day, I was like, I am not like these people.
Yeah.
You know, I could recognize. So you need to find and identify. Identification is the main thing in 12-step.
Well, but a lot of people, though, you find is a part of that, too. A lot of people go to 12-step and feel different.
Yeah, I'm not saying like, they go to rehab and feel different.
I understand, but they got to identify what's in common.
Yeah, and you can tell them that, but they won't do it until they go and go and go and start to realize, oh, my God, I'm the same as these people.
That's right. Maybe the going and going, maybe I'm worse even. I'm so much a part of it. I'm worse than the rest. I just couldn't see it. But, you know, this is family in Al-Anon, patient in extended care treatment.
Detached with love is what they call it.
Well, I was going to say that. You were a little angry when you detached from Anthony Kiedis. And you really want to do it, frankly, the way if people want to relate to public figures that are doing this. I thought Khloe Kardashian did it about right. She was, I tried. I can't be around you killing yourself or getting a divorce. She finally detached with love. I love you. I think you're great, but I can't do this anymore. Then he nearly dies. That's what happens. And then she appropriately stayed married to help with the medical decision making, but not reengaging in the relationship, even though she cares deeply about him. That seems about right to me.
I never liked the using public figures as the example.
Well, so. But that's all. That's how they people you know, relate.
I know it's really touchy with that because. She's been on the cover of every magazine talking about it. So that's a little...
No,
that's
not
a little,
really. Not really. I'm sort of reading between the lines.
I was at Rite Aid last night buying nicotine gum, and it was on the cover of every one of them.
What was she saying?
I don't read them. I don't know.
Yeah, it's them...
Chloe and Lamar.
Yeah, it's them. It's them making an issue. She has been pretty quiet.
Oh, really?
She's not been out there. No. I've been defending her for a while because I think she's... I mean, he's bad. You know, he's dying of addiction.
I know.
Let's be clear. I mean, that was just not a little crack.
There
are
some other sports figures dying of addiction also, and we're going to get into that through the coming episodes.
Uh-oh. Anybody we know?
Yes, very close to us.
Oh, no.
So, you know.
Is he going to be willing to come on here?
He keeps denying it, but we'll see.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Well, so there's a good example of how we can't do anything. He's denying he's doing. We won't name who this is yet. I think if he hears this, he'll know what we're talking about.
I know. I'm feeling guilty now in my codependency.
But he doesn't tell us what's really going on. And even if he did, he won't accept any treatment. So
he'll accept treatment, I think, if we can break through what's really going on.
Well, but all right, here's a new man, another email. My husband, this is another shocking tale. Been using prescription meds for over 12 years, pain meds. Originally, it was due to an auto accident. Gave his
drug addict, obfuscation.
Yeah. 5 knee surgeries in 10 years. Final knee surgery, total knee replacement. He's 32.
Oh, yeah.
I believe the pain is gone. There's
drug
no
addict,
need to.
Drug addict.
I know.
Drug addict, obfuscation, medical obfuscation.
Hold a second. We agree he has a dependency on pain meds. He doesn't know how to get off them and is scared. Disappointed by a hotline. Stating a person on the line said, husband would need to check himself in treatment facility for a minimum of 2 months, and it would be far away from me, our 2 small kids. If he didn't do it, he would die. They told him the truth. They told her the truth. We've both seen all the intervention shows, understand what is involved, but the situation seems a little less extreme than the shows we watch. He has a very important job, cannot afford to take months off. Is there help out there that would help him slowly wean the intake of the pills?
What kind of job can you do if you're wasted on pills?
I know, right? Is there also maybe support groups he can attend? All right, so here's the easier, kinder way. He can go to a...
Outpatient.
He can go to an outpatient treatment or even 12-step, but he's got to go on a daily basis.
He's got to titrate, though.
He can go on Suboxone and titrate off.
Yeah.
On Suboxone. If somebody takes him more than 2 weeks in that titration, maybe even 3 weeks. If they suggest he stay on the Suboxone.
For 12 years, 3 weeks.
All right. Then you have a bigger problem on your hands, though, if he can't get off the Suboxone. Then you have to be more willing to do the long-term thing. I think I have somebody on the line there. Let's see what that is. Is somebody Skyping in? No, it was not them.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it sounded like a Skype. So they told him a reasonable and dogmatic answer, which is, yeah, you need 2 or 3 months of treatment away. That would definitely have a better outcome. But going a lesser route, if you want to try it, tapering as an outpatient on Suboxone and then going to 12-step and or outpatient treatment. But it's not likely to work if he's really an opiate addict.
I
want to
get into the labels now.
Yeah.
So why does everybody hate the term drug addict?
I don't know, because I love it. Because people feel it's pejorative.
It explained everything about me.
Non-addicts feel, non-addicts or non-addicts and resistant addicts feel it's pejorative.
I'm addicted to drugs. I must be a drug addict.
I know. We can't do that. We have to call it a substance use disorder.
Substance use disorder.
Yeah, that's what we have to call it now, because it's too pejorative to call it drug addiction. It's giving addictions the term... This reminds me of back when the pain medicine thing was getting going. Who are you to say what pain is? All the pain, the lunatics getting
a
control of the asylum.
A human being who's lived with pain.
I'm fine with them calling substance use disorders and the way they've classified it in DSM-5, but let's also retain the term addiction, because it really is the catch-all that all disciplines can use.
So now, because I see America as one big addict population on a certain level, because of food.
Oh, yeah.
Because of food.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So why is that term so repulsive to our society?
I don't know.
It's racism, Drew. Because who were drug addicts traditionally up until the 1960s?
Well, I know that yes.
Addict populations were in the minority population.
But not just minorities, but underclass, lower socioeconomic.
Yes, for sure.
So there's a whole, I agree with, there's a really serious class conversation that needs to be had in this country that we are just shying away from for reasons I don't understand.
So doctors and people like that can't be drug addicts.
Right.
Only musicians.
That's right.
Or
people of color, people of color, immigrants.
Yeah, yeah,
we vilify
drug addicts.
Watch the show, The Nick Bob. Will you fucking watch that show?
No,
it shows all where all this all came from at the turn of the century. It's still with us.
Well, here's the funny thing. I work with the Wounded Warriors and they don't like the term either. Soldiers don't like the term addict.
Yeah. Because it sounds weak.
Isn't that?
Yeah, it makes
so
sense.
If we have a disorder that's killing our nation.
Yeah, you're not allowed
no
to even name it.
And no one wants to even,
can't even
be called it.
You can't even name it.
That might have something to do with it.
Well, let's think of a term. We need to.
Oh,
I had
a term.
It.
I came up with this years ago, and Bob and I used to work together. Remember?
Trauma survivor.
No. Remember?
What was
Rad.
It?
Remember Rad?
What?
You don't remember this? I used to give lectures every Wednesday, and I would go, listen, you guys are so screwed up by calling addiction. I describe what's going on in the brain, and I go, you see, it's your reward system, so let's call it reward activation disorder.
Yeah,
reward system activation disorder, RAD. It's a RAD. I got RAD.
That's
perfect.
The more,
yes,
again,
yes.
Again, well, do it again.
Distillation of all that, yes.
Yeah.
Reward activation disorder.
Yeah.
Perfect. You have to constantly, that part of your
brain.
How
does that work with food?
It's not catchy enough.
How does it work? Yeah, it's not. How does it work with food?
Food is a little more complicated, but it does. It's, if you really get going with it, you need satiation and the gratification and the reward.
And habituation.
Yeah. Well, reward. It's reward. It's do it again. And dependency on that reward activation as a way of managing affect and then being dependent on it.
So can you see that I'm talking about 50% of the population at least have some sort of addictive disorder?
I'm sighing because it's all back to the attachment stuff.
We don't know how to raise our children?
Because we've had attachment deficiencies, we've had insecure attachments, we provide further insecure attachments.
I think it all comes from parenting, so let's look at this.
Yeah.
The turn of the century, my dad's...
And by the way, there's a Facebook thing going on out there where this guy is saying, addiction is really all about trauma. It's not about, don't let anybody tell you anything else. No, of course. You and I have been saying that for decades.
One ingredient.
But it activates the addiction. Yes,
so,
absolutely.
So child rearing post, at the turn of the century, coming into my dad's parents were distant, abusive.
Yeah.
That's just the way the society was. Yeah. My dad was an educated man. He knew, he never put a hand on any of us, but he was still a trauma survivor of that, born in 1918. But a lot of the things he did as a parent or the way he wanted order in his family were correct.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So we all
humans need that structure and order and things and a little bit of...
Three out of four graduate from college. Yeah. 2 out of 3 have very successful lives. 2 out of 4. You go to our generation, the baby boom. I'm a late baby boomer. We're horrible parents. the horrible generation of parenting. We're the ones that invented everybody gets a trophy.
Yeah.
We're the one that invented you're the most special, greatest person that ever lived.
Because it's what I wanted, or if I see you having any discomfort, I can't tolerate it, so I got to make sure you don't feel bad.
Well, but it's not preparing your children for the real world.
Yeah, real world is... Life is miserable.
Real world, don't give a fuck.
Yeah, life is miserable. You have some unpleasant feelings. I'm here for you.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to take the feelings away.
There you go.
Yeah. Because if you... Oh, is it time, Susan? What are you looking at us for?
Too negative.
What is that?
Too negative.
What is that?
No, we're getting close, but you guys are... You're on to something.
Too negative?
What are you thinking?
No, I was just trying to tell you we're getting close.
Oh, close to
but
the end.
So what I want is
that's what this,
I want
that's
a,
what this is
okay.
About. This
I just want a support network for parents that are willing to use common sense, right? To use common sense and
yes.
Do the right thing. We need a family support system to use common sense.
But unfortunately, I'm not sure we have the emotional landscape to really do that with a kind of effectiveness. It's the difference between detaching with love, like with an addict, and just being pissed off and
yeah,
lowering
you can't
the boom.
Do it. I try to get coach parents away from doing it, expecting a result that they want.
Yeah,
right. That's where the anger comes from. Oh God, okay. Yeah. It's more like, listen, this isn't working. What you've been doing for 10 years,
yeah.
And I agree that some of his difficulties in functioning in our society are your fault. But the fact is, he's 26 years old and can't function in our society. So unless you're willing to subsidize his ability to function in our society, pay his rent,
yeah.
Pay his cell phone bill, pay his car insurance or whatever, but they want the rehabs to fix all that.
Yeah,
and that's why the system is broken.
Yeah,
because it can't fix that. It can't, you know, I tell the story. I went to Mount Rushmore with a client who we had a court case there. And
Mount
we were,
Rushmore?
South Dakota?
In
South Dakota. He had a court case there. And we flew up there and we had court in the morning and they recognized me from Celebrity Rehab, the bailiff, and the judge wanted to meet me. And I said, I think this is going to go really good. So that we were put first on the docket, out of there at 9:05,
wow.
Got everything we wanted. So we had the flight back was at 4:00, so we had nothing to do. We're in Mount Rushmoreville, right? So I said, well, let's go to Mount Rushmore. And he goes, where is that?
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, it's Mount Rushmore Holiday Inn we're staying in, and the Mount Rushmore, you know what I mean? Mount Rushmore is in the mini, you know, everywhere.
Yeah.
And so he goes, he Googles it or looks it up, and he goes, oh, it's like 45 miles from here. I go, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah.
We're going to go to Mount Rushmore, dude. And we go there, and it's freezing cold. We're in Mount Rushmore, just me and this young 20-year-old guy. And we walk out to it, and it's just like 25 degrees. And I want him to take my picture by Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
How many times do you get to be there?
Yeah.
And we're driving back, and he's looking out the window. I go, what are you thinking about, dude? And he goes, why would that guy spend 3 years of his life to do that?
Yeah.
I was like, because it's awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know, because he wanted to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so weird to like have this
nothing be meaningful. Everything
it's not
be.
About him. It's not about the guy that did it. He could have been doing something for himself.
Yeah.
But he, you know, if you know the story, he slept in a little house there in the freezing cold and he worked the wall, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just like, because people used to do badass shit.
Yeah.
For no reason.
To say they've done it. to do it.
They didn't have an iPhone.
I know.
No, you're right. That's an interesting way of saying it. Yeah. They didn't have other distractions.
But it was so incomprehensible to a modern young person.
Well, that's,
in
again, the doing something bigger than the self.
Selfless
that,
also.
Yeah.
It's
and
kinda like,
right. It's an homage to somebody. And that's the stuff we're always trying to coach them on. There's stuff bigger than you out there, everybody. However you understand that. Whatever that is, however you construct that.
What's going to be interesting is when this generation, 20-something generation, so ill-prepared for reality, enters... 50, 55, 60, looking down at less time here than you had.
Yeah.
And all, I think I perceive what they're wasting, not being prepared for living.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's such an avoidant culture, video games and Facebook and just avoid, avoid, avoid. Imagine this generation. They're going to end up being 60 years old. They're going to have avoided everything for the whole time they were here. What's that going to be like?
I don't know. I'm just thinking, it feels awful to even think about it.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So put down your phone. I do it all the time.
And by the way, the solution is real simple. Keep it simple. Family, friends.
Play baseball.
Yeah.
It's do simple. Stuff. Play catch.
Nourishing activities.
Go on a walk.
Remember Freeno always said, keep life simple. People need a simple life.
Yeah.
Work, you can love, do something play. More complex if you can tolerate it, but but it's not going to add that much.
And there's a thing in the Big Book of AA. It says we know about the alcoholic personality. It says we know, we think we know better how to solve the world's problems, and we don't even balance our own checkbooks. Right?
That's narcissism writ loud.
Yeah. So there you go.
All right, Susan from Susan Pinsky from Calling Out with Susan Pinsky. Is it time for us to wrap this thing up? Is that what I see you anxiously leaning into your mic for?
No, it's good. It's just, it could go another hour.
Well, do you want to do another hour?
The parenting?
No. No. We'll have to do that next time.
Next time.
We got lots. Bob and I have lots to say. And by the way, I still didn't tell the story about how we met.
Well, let's think of the first time. Go ahead. The way I recall it is,
we have time?
I walked in.
You have 8 minutes.
Oh, I can tell.
I walked in. And you were, this is in my mind's eye, which you never can trust. I walked into the booth at the K-Rock that was on Burbank Boulevard,
yes,
you know, in Burbank.
Olive and
you were
Riverside.
Standing behind the console.
Yep, that's where I used to stand.
Right?
Yep.
And it was, but remember Louis that you ended up working at MTV? He was an intern for you?
Yeah.
That's who I knew.
Louis Largent.
Louis. Yeah. That's who I knew.
Yeah.
And
oh God, we should get back in touch. We should get Louis as a guest. Hey, Susan,
that would be great.
Susan, we can do that. We still have connections with him.
All right.
And
Louis Largent, guest.
And he had like Thelonious Monster or something. I think that's how I was on. This is before the thing that you say. This is a couple years before the thing, because I just
well
was
tell
on
what you mean
like,
by the thing.
Well, when you say you're going to make a great therapist, if you could stop taking it.
There's a documentary about Bob's life called the Bob and the Monster, and in there they took a piece of audio from some radio he and I had done a couple years
and
after
that's
we first
in 88
met.
Because that album that I'm promoting came out in 88.
Okay,
but
I
had seen each other 2 years prior.
Okay,
when was that Pasadena building of Cairo? I mean that Burbank building.
That was like probably 88 to 94, 95. Maybe.
Well, when I
maybe
went
96.
There, that was the first time it had been there. 86 is when it was there, I think. Because I'd been to the Pasadena one that looked like a dental office.
Yeah, yeah. It was terrible.
Then it moved there, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first time I ever walked into the booth, I was like, fuck, K-Rock's badass now. This is really real.
When it was in a building.
Yeah. In a building with like real equipment.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in there, Bob was loaded again, but I was
really drunk that time when I saw you behind the console.
And I load in. I go, Bob, you would make a good therapist if you would ever get your shit together, because he was talking to somebody very sincerely. And they pulled that and put that in the documentary. So then Bob gets worse, sicker and sicker and sicker with his addiction. And I told everyone we have to keep away from this guy because we don't want to be, first of all, he's dying. We're watching him die and I can't stand it. We're participating in it. We have to grieve the loss of Bob Forrest and just get on with things. But he can't come around here. He's using, he has AIDS. I said all the things he probably does. As you said, you use the fact that you look like you had AIDS as
to get money.
As telling people that you did have AIDS, because then people would feel bad for you and you'd get money out of them.
Yeah.
It's hysterical. fast forward now, we lose touch with each other entirely. You go through multiple treatments. You have to watch the documentary to see Bob's course.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to 2000, what?
Three, probably.
2003.
I was working at Music Cares, Matt.
Music Assistance Program. It's a program that funded treatment for musicians. And Bill's Nye, the science guy.
He needed extras.
He needed extras for...
So I brought my whole group. It was like 20 of us.
Yeah. And I was lecturing. Winnie was in that group, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was.
Yeah, funny. I just remember. I'm picturing the group in my mind. I remember her sitting there. And it was a lecture I was giving about addiction. He went and he was up there with me, and he was going to cut
the brain.
He was going to put this into his little documentary or special. And I'm giving this lecture, a lecture I often give. And in the front row is this guy in a hat with red hair, challenging me and asking me questions and stuff. And they're all good and like they were like really knowledgeable questions. I go, man, this guy knows his shit. And I go, isn't it funny? He looks like Bob Forrest, but Bob Forrest is dead. There's no way that's Bob Forrest. And so afterwards, I think you came up to me at the very end, right?
Yeah, I thought you knew it was me.
I had no idea. I just thought you were a guy that looked like Bob Forrest, because Bob Forrest was dead. I was totally convinced.
So the time from when we saw each other, probably the last time was in 90, because I had that record come out in 90. So it was
13, 14 years. Yeah. And any event, you look much healthier now.
I feel better.
And we talked, and you were working at, I think you were doing some work at Pasadena Recovery Center.
Yeah, I was starting to do the groups out there.
And I think we saw each other.
Because I had gotten certified.
I think I saw you up there then, right? I remember visiting.
A short time later.
Yeah, that's we started. I don't know why I was up there.
You know why?
Why?
Because Mike Bloom thought if he gets Bob Forrest to run groups over PRC, then all the map clients will go there.
Okay, that's
fine. Which was a smart move.
Yeah, smart move.
Then Pat Martin had the same idea at Los Angeles.
yeah. Well, that was Lee Bloom then, but Mike wasn't even making the big decisions,
I know, but... But Mike knew that I was the one. So then, really, if you recall, I met Roland and Pat Martin and Buddy Arnold over at Lost and Seniors before you had said, come work here.
Okay, we're talking about the CEO and the clinical outreach.
Because in 2003, that same year, they were going to give us Duncan House to map out of.
Right, that's right. Okay. So there was a house outside the back of this hospital that they were going to use as a musician's assistance program, sort of sober living is what they were going to do. I remember that. And they were talking to you and Buddy Arnold, who's the head of musician's assistance program, about this. And somehow I remember up at PRC one day, I said, you know, we could really use somebody like you. Maybe I'll come down to Los Angeles and think about getting involved here.
Well, your evening outpatient person had, I had sex with a client and had to be fired. That's what really happened.
I don't think it was our evening outpatient program. It was our lead counselor.
Okay, so then you bounced the evening outpatient counselor to the lead counselor role, and that opened up.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, work at Lawson's.
Yes, we
needed
somebody.
But I was also scared. Something happened immediately, and it was boundary violations, let's call it.
For me?
No, for somebody that worked for you. That's how the job opened up.
No, job opened up because a counselor...
So only because somebody did something wrong.
Yeah, right. Well, that's...
I love shit like that.
Okay, he was dating a former client. Really,
but you know what I'm saying? I love happenstance
yes.
That you and I were getting reacquainted, and all of a sudden this job opened up.
Yes,
at your rehab.
That's right. And so you went to outpatient. I forgot that's how you went.
Yeah, evening outpatient.
And then we kind of moved Bob slower and slower into the inpatient side, and then made him sort of a director there. And then we had an administrator change, and she really relied on you heavily to really start running the programs.
That was fun.
And so Bob went from a counselor to a outpatient program to an inpatient program to a program director at a psychiatric hospital. And those are big jobs.
We had big good jobs. Teaching things. You and Barry taught me.
Barry Plum is the other physician that we worked with.
Then I taught my staff.
Yeah.
And it was more like an education in this amiable, there was a quality there of passing information down. We're all on the same page kind of.
The other thing, well,
doesn't exist in rehab anymore.
I know. We had to create a unity because you have to have absolute unity when you're treating people like that. And the other thing, we were evolving the field at the time. Things were evolving in real time. It was still a field that was coming into focus. All right, we got to wrap this up. It's another This Life with Bob Forrest and Dr. Drew. Again, Amazon banner, emails.
Let's just put that in a nutshell. Me, Nutcase Bob, the worst drug addict in Hollywood, ended up the director of a hospital.
If you'd put it that way at the time, I'm not sure he would have gotten that job.
I think Music Cares
did a great job.
Became a huge, huge...
Music Cares was a separate thing that absorbed Musicians Assistance Program.
Right, and they became a huge
it's a big deal.
Philanthropic organization
it's the biggest
that's
deal
raised
in the world.
A ton of money for musicians with drug problems.
Yes, and check out Music Cares. Just Google it if you want to hear anything.
I know, when the first time we ever honored anybody, I forget, because it's fundraising, right? That's what you're referring to. The first one was... Bonnie Raitt, because she was a big supporter and she was sober, right?
Yep.
And it was at the Hilton Hotel. There was like 300 people there, right?
Yep.
I think we lost money because we didn't know what we were doing.
I think we went to that. Whiskey or something.
Yeah.
To do that.
And then.
Oh,
and then,
these are the Key Club. There was one. Remember that
one?
Yeah,
there was Key Club.
Yeah.
Those are middle ones.
Yeah.
But the last one was honoring Bob Dylan and grossed like $10 million.
Yeah, they raise amazing amounts.
Yeah, we were one for Bruce Springsteen.
Okay, so we need to wrap this up. We'll talk about that later.
All right. So, we got lots.
Call us up, email us up, at wherever the hell it is.
DrDrew.com.
Bob and I have lots to talk about still, so we'll keep this thing going. And if you like it, please tell a friend.
This is a real life. Oh, this is the only one you get. This does not repeat, no.